short out of one of those power supplies. I took the transistor that drives the transformer and put it on a separate heatsink that's much larger than the one that was on the board. Runs much cooler, and I was able to take almost 20 amperes out of it for 10, 15 minutes, and just the heatsink just got basically warm. I adjusted the power supply to give me 13.6 volts. So, you see, there again. Now, I know, I easily could have gone out and bought power supplies whenever I needed a 12-volt power supply or whatever. I'm running, in fact, on one of these ones right now, this salvage computer. But it shows you that, you know, people laugh, like Dick just said, how much stuff is tossed out for very little or no reason that's still usable. And as a ham radio operator, at one time it was, a situation when I was a teenager where I had to salvage. I had to come up with ideas to, you know, make things work out of nothing, whatever I could possibly find. But I'll tell you, it was good training because later on in the real world, I was able to apply a lot of these things that so-called learned to improvise and make things work where in some cases looked like it was, oh, this is hopeless. And I would come up with a very good answer, and part of it is, I guess, is the so-called training. So I try to encourage, I try everybody out there, make something, build something. Even if it costs you a few dollars more than you think, I could buy this thing for, you know, X amount of dollars, and it's going to cost me a few extra dollars. But, you know, I say to you as a ham radio operator and also as an experimenter, give it a shot to see what happens. You'll see how much, how good a feeling you'll get that I made this, you know, and that, how proud you'll be. All right, let's go on. I think enough of that, Dick, unless you want to make some comments on any of this. Jazz over.
No, I've got a very similar philosophy. Mel and I were born the same month, the same year. We went to some of the same schools. We didn't meet each other until we got on the ham radio. And as such, we enjoy making things work. I could tell by that earlier conversation we were having with, I think it was Rich, yeah, KT2, TTY, I think it was, the guy with the MFJ tuner that he bought on the flea market. And it was in fairly bad shape, but I can tell he's got some pride by replacing the part that was damaged and making it work. And therefore, he probably got it at a very nice price because it was non-operational. There are certain rigs that I really fall in love with. You take, for instance, an oldie but goodie, this thing you're listening to right now, a Kenwood TS711A. I got to put a better microphone on it so it gets a little bit cleaner audio, but it's got the cleanest looking synthesizer I have ever seen. It's a 1978, a 2-meter all-mode rig, 30 watts of output. But the nice thing about this Kenwood is that it's got a knob on the front panel where I can adjust the power output continuously from 1 watt to 30 watts. When you're feeding transverters, boy, that is handy. It's got a built-in 110-volt power supply. Not the most compact rig, but it'll run on 12 volts or 110, built-in power supply. Only got 30 memories, doesn't have a whole lot of horns and whistles. But when I wanted one of those rigs, and I now own two or three of them, I'm not sure how many I've got, and I've got the 450 version of it too, I would be willing to buy one that's thrown down a flight of stairs and the front panel is dented, because there's no single component in there that's very expensive except the main power transformer. And that's a very rugged device that's not likely to fail. Everything else in there, maybe with a microprocessor that would be a bit of a pain to replace. But shy of that, everything else is very repairable for a guy that's crafty enough. So, ham radio, if you buy the latest and greatest rigs with all the horns and whistles, you can easily spend $4,500. If you're a little bit more crafty and you buy something that doesn't look great, but if you've done enough research and you find out it is a brand name and a model number that people have fallen in love with, and they hold on to it. And who cares if it's 20 years old? And you can get it for $130, and it's going to be equal in performance on most of the parameters of that $2,000 rig. And even if it's got a couple of glitches, you meet your buddy Andy, W2CDL, at the next tuning clinic of a Limonk Hamvention, and it will be flying. So with the right attitude, you can make things work, and that's an awful lot of the fun of doing this, in my opinion. You can brag about the bargain you've done. It's an educational process. Anyone want to add any comments to that? Give me a call with us right now.
Yeah, it's who we are, Rick.
Go ahead, Rich. Let's hear about some of your experiences.
Okay, well, I've explored a lot of equipment over the years. I take a slightly different attitude. I'd say, you know, if you can buy it for the same cost of building it, you're probably better off buying it and taking the time and building something unique that you can buy. I feel pretty good about this 2-2 Simulac, the pair of 8877s I built up, because you can't buy that. It's unavailable. The Singer 8877, yeah, but you can't buy an amplifier with a parent. And another nice thing to do is to take the old Collins or an old Capoe or a chassis and strip it down, get the chassis replated if you want to go that far, and, you know, just build it up from scratch. You've got yourself a new old rig, something that can't be bought. You have to build a thing like that.
KC2OES. Go ahead, Fred. Thank you, Rich. Go ahead, Fred.
I undertook a project that I didn't think I could do, but it was a matter of dollars that I didn't have. I had 3 SWR power meters from the 80s. I took one of them and decided to learn what makes it do what it does and convert it to VHF, UHF, and I was successful.
KC2RSF.
Mr. RSF. Thank you, Fred. KC2RFF. That's Radio Frank Sierra. Start off with your name, sir, and your comments.
I was just going through the frequencies here, and I caught you on there. What repeater am I on? Over.
You're on the 146.85 repeater, run by Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club. It's located right on the border between Nassau and Suffolk counties. I guess it's about 15 miles east of New York City, in the middle of Long Island. Go ahead, sir.
All right, I'm on an HT over here in Kingsburg, New Jersey, County of Monmouth, actually in my bedroom. And I recognize your voice from my mobile, but I wasn't sure what repeater I was on. I had some scanning the channels, and you were coming in here as if you were local. That's how great you were coming in. How received my frequency over there in Long Island, over?
Yeah, loud and clear over here, Michael. And this is the technical net that we run every Sunday night. You're in the middle of it. I'm now going to pass it back over to, Mel who gets it. And Mel, you know anybody who takes pride in taking an oldie but goodie, like a piece of Collins equipment, taking it apart, shining it up, treating it with tender loving care, repainting, waxing, and making it like a museum piece, so when people come and look at it, they say, wow, boy, it would be fun to own one of those. And the thing that looks like a piece of Collins equipment you got that's got the very fancy automatic tuner in it, they think it's another piece of Collins equipment they've never seen. There's got to be some kind of a way, Mel, that you can find a Collins label you can put on there, a phony label. I mean, back in the days when transistors were just starting to become popular, this is when you had a 2N43 transistor that was being used in the audio intercom circuits that Telephonics was manufacturing. I was working in the final testing department, and we had some serious discussions about making a phony transistor. We're going to make a great big package. We were going to call the 2N5000. We're going to put a real transistor on the inside so a person could make measurements with an ohmmeter and do a curve tracing, and it would act like a transistor. But this thing was going to be about 6 inches in diameter with great big studs on it, and it was going to be called the 2N5000. Boy, we would have had a lot of fun with that had we followed through with it. Now, if you can get a Collins label for your particular piece of equipment and give it a fancy model number and call it the Flybody Labradider or the Greasy Mawatsu Machigaman Doodle made by Collins, boy, you can have a lot of fun with that. Back to you, Mel.
Well, of course I did that. This is K2KEY. I got a label. That's it. I got a Collins symbol. And that went on there. That's what throws them all off, because how could this be? And when I tell them it was special production, my God, oh boy. You know, I guess this represents, put it out, most likely, maybe on eBay or something, and say, one of only productions that was specially made, maybe for Bill Collins, but I think I'd get myself into trouble. Anyhow, what it is, Dick, it's, pride in the workmanship and everything, so it's just that I try to instill in the young people today. I do get to meet a number of young people from the tutelages and all, and, we're going to get into a whole involvement now again with education and all, and the recent experience I had with a friend, a young son, started algebra and was failing all the tests and all, and how to, he was frantic already. I sat down, I talked with him, and all I asked him is two words. I said, I'm going to ask you two words. You know, you just started algebra, yeah? Intermediate algebra, yeah? I said, I just want to ask you two words. I said, tell me, did you ever hear the word involution and evolution? And he looked at me. I may have spoken, should have spoken Greek, because how a teacher would look at his homework and see he gets the same thing wrong over and over or on his test. But this is the system now. It's all interrelated to what's going on there. So I'm not going to get into it, but I just say it just, reminds me of this. So many of these situations I hear, and just people don't want to, they don't want to put in no effort. It's everything you want to do is push a button, and that's it. If the button you push don't work, throw the thing out. Let me get another one. That's what it comes down to. All right, I think we should go on, Dick, over.
Yeah. Roughly how many emails did you get this week, Mel?
Yeah, I get a lot of them. A lot of them just reading over here. I'm not even going to bother anything. Commenting on them. Let's see. Oh, here's one that's interesting. A couple of weeks ago, you guys discussed the radio spectrum.
Yes.
And you said that the radio spectrum seems to be somewhere from 3 kilohertz, say, to about 300 gigahertz.
Right.
Or, as I said, around 0.3 centimeters. And what happens after that? In the infrared, you said there's infrared after that?
Yes.
Invisible light, ultraviolet, right? X-rays, gamma rays, and so forth. What actually are you doing when you get into those zones, like getting above 100 gigs? Do you need a license to experiment? Is that no longer considered radio communication? I don't know. How do they actually categorize if we go above 100 gigs? Do we say we're out of the range of what we classify radio spectrum, Dick? Over.
I think the answer is yes, Mel. Obvious by the fact that the current distance record with infrared and optical is something like 156 miles. A group of guys from the North Texas Microwave Society use something like a laser pointer connected to the eyepiece of a telescope, located themselves on top of a high hill in northern Texas. A similar group of guys with another laser pointer, and the laser pointer, by the way, had a modulator. The two flashlight batteries in there, the AAA batteries, were going through some kind of a pulse modulator, so that the light coming out was being modulated with an actual signal that had information on it. The guys in Oklahoma were on another mountaintop, 156 miles apart. They talk to each other. You and I know that you don't need a license to run a laser pointer. And these guys did what you and I would call radio-like communication. And they were doing it at, I'm going to pick a number, 50 terahertz. Or actually, let me think now. I can figure that one out. The center of the optical band is 10 to the 14. They were around 10 to the 13. Yeah, they were around 50 terahertz. Terahertz is 10 to the 12. Yeah. 50 terahertz is close to the frequency they were on. When it comes to licensing agreements, right now, it used to be all above 30 gigahertz. Now it's all above 300 gigs. To my knowledge, the FCC does not directly control anything above 300 gigahertz. So if you wanted to build a 301 gigahertz transmitter, it is my belief you can do it without an FCC license, and you're not going to be interfering with anybody, and very good pure research. Right now, Brian Justin, W-A-1-Z-M-S, he lives in Virginia, but he's heavily involved with the Mount Greylock VHS Society. He's involved in their June and September contest. He is the current distance holder in the United States for 120 gigs, 243 gigs, and something like 410 gigs. I'm not sure of the next higher frequency above 300. But he just chose a higher harmonic coming out of his gun oscillator assembly, put it through a smaller diameter piece of tubing so only the higher frequency came out, and made a two-way Q-cell. It was only a mile or so, but it's an official Q-cell, because he made two of these setups, and him and his buddy, on two mountaintops, a mile and a half apart. When you're up to those frequencies, the main thing you have to worry about is water vapor absorption and oxygen absorption. For certain specific frequencies, like around 60 gigs, oxygen has a whole lot of resonance and will give you a whole lot of absorption. It's kind of amazing when you go even higher in frequency to the optical band, but the atmosphere on a clear day when there's no clouds in the sky turns more transparent again. If you could put a higher and higher frequency to your dipole and make the dipole smaller and smaller, when you eventually got up to 10 to the 14 hertz, in a dark room, you would see the dipole glowing because your eye operates at that frequency. I'll admit that we use other kinds of emitting devices besides the dipole up there, but in theory, you could do that. So the spectrum doesn't suddenly change when you go from RF to infrared, far infrared, near infrared, optical, ultraviolet, X-ray, and so on. It's the exact same spectrum. And use different kinds of transmitters and different kinds of detectors. The human eye works very nicely between 400 and 700 nanometers. That's where your eye operates. Your eye is a receiver that operates over one octave. And if you tune to the low end of the band, your eye says...
TOS, lockup detect.
When you tune to the low end of the band, your eye says, aha, that is red. Tune to the middle of the band, and your eye says, that's yellow or green. Tune to the high end of the band, and your eye says that's a blue or ultraviolet. We have a frequency selective receiver. That's the cones of your eye, which look at the relative amount of red, green, and blue and figure out the in-between colors. That's what you perceive as color. It's really a frequency frequency selective receiver. Your eye is a spectrum analyzer. Ain't that interesting? Your eye...
Note number 4478. Link clear.
Your eye really is a spectrum analyzer. As you can tell, the guys doing work on our repeaters are doing a bunch of experiments. That's some of the stuff you're hearing in the background. So, ain't that interesting? I've never used those words before. Your eye is a spectrum analyzer. And it can resolve bandwidth or frequency. That's what it's really doing when you see red, green, orange, blue, and so on. We call it color. It really is frequency. You can plot those colors on a chart where wavelength is horizontal and amplitude is vertical. And your eye does that for you, and you don't even have to bother.
An error has occurred.
You don't...
TOS, lockup detect.
You don't even have to make a graph out of it. Your eye just interprets it as color. When you go down to the infrared, you have to go into other kinds of displays and other ways of making it visual, putting it onto a kind of a television screen, so to speak. So, if you look at what's happened over the last 100 years of radio, each decade, the frontier moves close to 10 times higher in frequency. So you jump ahead.
An error has occurred. TOS, lockup detect.
You jump ahead 10 years in time, and the frontier has moved 10 to 1 higher in frequency. We ham radio operators in the 1915 to 1920 time period, everyone thought that above 3 megacycles was absolutely useless. You go hams, go use it with whatever you want. And we discovered that ionospheric reflection, ionospheric bouncing of signals, so to speak, and long-range communication was possible. It was ham radio operators, essentially, that really discovered the fine details of that.
Link active. Node number 4478. Link clear. Link.
Yeah. The higher frequencies always are more useful, and it doesn't end. When I first got into ham radio, anything above 30 gigahertz was considered Never Never Land, and the FCC requirements in the mid-50s and 60s would say all above 30 gigahertz, do whatever you want. There is no licensing requirement. Now it's above 300 gigahertz. And there are companies right now, like Militech, among other companies, that are doing some very worthwhile experiments at those kind of frequencies. They're called quasi-optical techniques. You can literally build an antenna in what looks like a magnifying glass, but it's made out of a foam-like material, and it focuses radio waves from the so-called terahertz or near terahertz frequencies. And you get a lot of gain out of that, and you can scan it somewhat like a television set, and you make a photograph. You can make a passive thermal image of a human being. I've seen thermal images of what a human being looks like at 94 gigahertz. Very exciting stuff. And it's a great way of detecting weapons that are below the clothing, because it has a specific signature that shows up on a passive imaging camera at 94 gigahertz. And so there are amateurs that are using quite a bit higher frequencies than that. So really progressive amateurs. And you go to a microwave update, like I did a month and a half ago in Philadelphia, and you talk to these guys face-to-face who are using those frequencies, doing that research, and making those friends.
An error has occurred.
Communication
error has occurred. The link has been lost.
And they're making experiments with these frequencies. And back in the early days of ham radio, the hams that were using frequencies above 30 megs, we're being told, why are you doing that? It's never going to go very far. It's not very useful. That exact statement gets repeated every 10 years for the next higher frequency, 10 times higher frequency. There's no end to that. The future is up. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Just thinking about something. The band above 300 gig, I don't know. I remember once reading that they that's the terahertz band, Dick. Is that the way it's referred to over?
Technically, a terahertz is 1,000 gigs. So above 300 gigahertz, 300 gigahertz is exactly 1 millimeter wavelength. So if you go above 300 gigs, they call it sub-millimeter. So above 300 gigs is sub-millimeter, and they would call it near terahertz. But a terahertz is 1,000 gigs. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, Roger. Yeah, I thought that. I remember once saying that they considered anything above 300 gigs as 1 terahertz, the terahertz portion of the spectrum begins. Okay, so we continue up the spectrum. The highest that we can go is that what's widely accepted as the cosmic ray portion of the spectrum. I'm just kind of off the top of my head. You most likely be much more familiar. When we started, go somewhere around 10 to the 24th, 25th, something like that. Power is a hertz. Is that what is the top of the spectrum? In other words, if we started down at the very low frequency VLF. I don't know where that starts, VLF, actually, what they call it, infrasonic, below 10 hertz, and we go all the way up to the other end, to 10 to 20-something, 23rd, 4th, 5th, or whatever it is. Is that the end of the spectrum thickest we know it right now on the Earth over?
I'd like to believe that there is no end. If you looked at the latest PBS program on cold, COLD, it's a NOVA program that was shown last Thursday and repeated a few times. People didn't know what cold was. They eventually discovered there is absolute zero, minus 273 degrees Kelvin. You can't go below that because temperature really is the average kinetic energy of the molecules. Well, if the molecules stop moving, you've gone that cold, you can't go beyond stop. So there is a limit on the low end. When it comes to temperature, and that's almost what you're talking about, there is no limit at the high end. As you go to higher and higher temperatures of a substance, very similar to what happens with the filament of a light bulb, or you're aiming a blowtorch at a chunk of steel. It starts off as a dull red that you see in a dark room. Eventually becomes a bright red, eventually becomes yellow, eventually becomes white, eventually becomes blue. As something gets hotter and hotter, it emits higher and higher frequencies, which your eye sees as the color going from red toward blue, toward ultraviolet, and beyond. So there's a relationship between wavelength and color when it comes to optics detected by a human eye. Is there a limit to the highest possible frequency? Whoever sets a limit is going to be wrong. There is no limit on the high end. You can go to soft x-rays, hard x-rays, gamma rays, cosmic ray, and beyond. They have recently discovered a burst of energy from some kind of an event going on in space that is terrifically higher in power than anyone ever anticipated. Mother Nature has ways of creating really big chunks of power. And maybe it's a white dwarf meeting a black hole. Maybe it's a pair of black holes as a binary star. And by the way, there are more binary stars than unary. Our particular star is a lonesome star all by itself. It's a little bit more rare compared to binaries. There are more binaries and trinaries than there are unaries. So there's lots of stars running around each other, and when they eventually dissipate their gravitational energy and come together, all hell breaks loose. And if one of those happens to be a black hole eating a white dwarf or a neutron star, you get a burst of energy like you wouldn't believe. People can make some guesses as to what happens when a pair of black holes come together. Well, then there are black holes and there are black holes. The center of each galaxy has got a supermassive black hole. Some of them are 10 billion solar masses. Take the mass of the sun, which you and I consider damn big, and take something 10 billion times heavier. And in some cases, that's the center of a galaxy that holds all those stars together. What happens if you get a pair of those big guys coming together? What kind of a burst of energy does that give you? If a gamma ray burst, I'm not quite sure what that is, it could be just a pair of neutron stars coming together. When you get a gamma ray burst, anything within 22 light years is cooked and gone. And people have speculated about whether or not that's the causative agent of the five major mass extinctions we've had on this planet in the past millions of years. So, is there a limit to the highest frequency or the highest possible energy? I'm convinced the answer is no. Because 10 times before, throughout mankind's study of science, we thought we knew what the upper end was, and we're always wrong. I'm not convinced there is an upper end, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Right now, like I said, we consider our spectrum as standard spectrum. Actually, is it official that we consider right now?
Node number 4478. Link active.
Whatever it is, I think it's 10 to, what is it, 24 or 25? Is that what we can right now consider the upper limit right now, or have they expanded that thing over?
Okay, here you go. Go ahead, here we go, Eric.
Yeah, I just want to apologize. But, you know, I'm writing some scripts here. They're not exactly working out right, but we're getting there. And I just kind of want to apologize to you for all those nasty announcements behind you.
We tolerated that. So that's better than some of the other things we tolerated, though, Steve. Don't worry. I mean, Eric, don't worry. I think you're right, Mel. Let me think now. In the front cover of some of the books that were printed by John Krauss, W-H-A-K, particularly his books on radio astronomy, he shows the whole spectrum from DC to cosmic rays. And I think it's 10 to the 24 hertz, but I'm not positive about it. No matter what he's got in the book, because he published the book 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, guarantee we've seen things beyond that. NASA is continuously launching space probes that look for greater and greater amounts of energy, higher and higher frequencies, you could say, shorter and shorter wavelengths. And you want to make a picture of it. When you look at the universe in infrared, you get a particular picture. Look at it in far infrared with the Spitzer Space Telescope, you get a different picture. Look at it with the Hubble Telescope, and you get an optical picture. Very different. Look at it with the Chandra gamma ray telescope, you get another picture. No matter which spectrum of the universe you use, you get a different picture. You favor different things. You go to the longer wavelength, and you're looking at the brown dwarf stars. You look at the shorter wavelength, and you're looking at the really violent things that are going on, like black holes and neutron stars and white dwarfs and so on. I'm not convinced there is a limit. It may be 10 to the 24 hertz right now, and I'll have to do a little bit of checking on that one. But if somebody said that that's the upper end of the spectrum, you better say that's the upper end of the spectrum in 2007 or 2008. I guarantee we're going to go beyond because we've done it lots of times before. People declared an end of the spectrum, and we went beyond. So all the evidence is there ain't no end. The future is up. Higher frequency, shorter wavelengths, more information can be packed in, more directivity comes out of the antennas. And by the way, one of the subjects that the A2LTM, or even now, Andy, the A2CDL wants us to talk about is how come when you go to the formula for space laws, why is it 20 dB log F? When you go to a higher frequency, why does free space seem to have more laws? In reality, space has no laws at all. So why does there appear to be less signal received when you go to higher frequencies and the same gain of the antennas? And there is an explanation for that, which we should go through. But I think we're getting behind in our mail. I'll send it back to you now. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Kate, this is K2KEY. I have to go on with this now. It's going to get late. Don't pick up emails. Everybody makes comments. Why don't you ever come up with my email? I answered a number of them myself, Dick. Let's see. Here's one that's interesting. I picked up a piece of equipment that was thrown out of a flight. And it looked like some kind of, at least I took it apart, looks like some kind of a transmitting device, but yet I don't see any place where an antenna connects onto it, but it's got, looks like coils, it's got a pair of two tubes, 811, it's got an 807 in it, it's got two 866s, a 5R4, and a crystal that says 6780 kilohertz. Kilocycle, KC. Do you have any idea what kind of a piece of equipment is made by Bircher? When he said, all right, I read Bircher, I really now get an idea of what it is, Dick. no wonder there's no place to connect the end with a tank well. That was not its, it was not meant as a transmitter, even though it's got transmitted circuits in it. Go ahead.
Was it a diatherming machine now?
That was going to be my guess. Is it a diatherming machine?
Of course, that's it. When Tesla gave it away, that it had a 6780 kilocycle crystal driving into it, using the 807. The 807 was the oscillator, right? Remember that machine from that, because I broke up a number of them. It provides you, yes, it'll provide you with a lot of nice parts. You can actually build yourself beginning of a linear amplifier with it. You got a power transformer in there that's going to, with the 866s on it, I will bet you it's delivering a couple thousand volts. And you can use the final, you can build a rig, you know, using the 811. The 807, of course, that, you can use that on some other project. But it surely has a lot of valuable parts in it for a ham radio operator, and I would bet that this was a diathermy machine. I would say to you not to turn it on. Don't try turning it on, doing anything with it other than you want to be careful. It's, that power supply can be really a killer, if I remember correctly, Dick, over.
Without a doubt, lots of voltage in there. 866s, I've used them on the 800-volt power supply for the 807 transmitter I built back in the 50s. I wonder what's the peak inverse voltage on an 866 mercury vapor rectifier. I don't think you can get 2,000 volts out of that, though. No. That would be 4 or 5,000 volts peak inverse voltage. I'm a little bit afraid that the mercury vapor rectifiers would give you a flashback at those voltages. Maybe you know more about that than I do. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. No. They're okay. The original design of the Collins KWS-1 that I have, U-866 is the mercury rectifiers in there. They light up nice blue. Nice blue too. You talk in the mic and you can really see a nice show going on in there. They're using that. Power supply is 2,000 volts. Look at those rigs that came out of the early days of the 50s and all the high-powered rigs of the kilowatts, the Johnson kilowatt desktop, the Henrys, and a number of them used 866s as their as the original rectifiers, mercury vapor, and then they changed them over to the 3D 28 takeover.
Yeah, the 3D28, wasn't that an argon-filled rectifier? Didn't that give you an orange glow instead of the deep blue glow of the mercury vapor rectifier 866? Go ahead.
See, I couldn't really see the glow in it because of the construction of the tube. What they did is they put that coating on that tube. There was a lot of talk, you know. There was a lot of talk about things, about radiation, this thing and that thing. And there was a number of cases where they said that for safety purposes that not to use the mercury vapor tubes anymore. Well, you know what it was? Mercury started to get a bad name, particularly, so they surely couldn't make those tubes anymore. And so the 3D28 came into, you know, general use. It was also, I think, a little bit more of a compact tube. Had a little lower profile, but I don't know. I think it was, again, I don't ever think there would have been anything wrong with using 866 thick past the 1970s over.
I'm trying to think of the latest time I used an 866. By the way, a buddy of mine went over, it was WB5BJB, Kent Britton, in Grand Prairie, Texas. Interesting character. He went over to the solid state equivalent of an 866 on a piece of equipment that used 866s. And the rig ran nice with the solid state equivalent, but he got lower voltage output. That mercury vapor rectifier, when it got ionized in the forward mode, was a very efficient rectifier. Gave you a very small voltage drop. The solid state equivalent that they made that plugged into the same socket had so many diodes in series to give it the right peak inverse voltage, and you add up all the voltage drop of all those silicon diodes and you had more voltage drop from the solid state equivalent. That's kind of crazy. There are a number of guys who have put in solid state diodes for a tube rectifier and they ended up with a lot higher voltage, but in that particular case for 866s, those tubes, when you ionize that gas inside, the higher the current you put through the tube, the lower the voltage drop. It's a really crazy tube. Very efficient. And I think 866s with that mercury vapor inside, which starts off as a pool of mercury at the bottom when you first turn on the filament, I believe those rectifiers must be operated in the vertical mode. If you put that tube on its side or upside down, without first preheating it, I'm not convinced it would start up correctly and work right. What do you think, Mel? Go ahead.
Okay. No, I believe I've never seen them in any other position except vertical. Okay. Never experimented with them in any position other than vertical. Never used them. Yep, nothing wrong with them. I still have a power supply with a good hefty power supply that's at least 3,000 volts. No, it's more than 3,000 volts. Using a pair of 866s in them. And nothing wrong with that. As a number of those transformers that were wound with and actually were, you know, plate caps came out of the transformer and everything. And the socket assembly, like Collins produced, they produced a Bakelite, an old-fashioned black Bakelite molded assembly that was part of that power supply and all. And the transformer and everything mounted onto it, and specifically made for use of 866s. So I would say to you that still, if you found a power supply that had 866s in it, it would be very viable if you were going to build an amplifier. So you don't have to rip them out and say, oh, I got to put in solid-state replacements. I think the 866s, like you say, will suffice. They'll give you that bang that you need for a kilowatt-plus amplifier. And as you say, replacing with solid-state, you know, diodes in a number of pieces of equipment, tube equipment, you got to be very careful. They did damage a number of rigs, especially a Collins circulator, or the Collins collected circulator around, not to modify their power supply that they use on the S-line, that take out the 5R4 that they use and put in the solid-state replacement for it, because you can get away with it, but it does jack up the voltage, especially the other two they have in there, the 5U4, they definitely said is a no-no, absolutely. Definitely damage those transmitters. So the word to the wise is, having it run hot, those power supplies, they can run hot cycle on these 5U4s and 5R4s. Put a little fan on it. That's the elegant answer. And don't try to go to solid-state, you know, replacements, because you can get into trouble with some respect. The 866 is my word as far as using it still. I don't see anything wrong with it. You know, it's going to be a bigger power supply, but if you happen to come across something like that, like this diathermy machine, that power supply is all set up to run an amplifier. You just put the rest together. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, well, my voice is about to give out. When I was a high school kid, I think it was the HN10 Memoria amplifier. In Harrison Radio, I think they were on, they were still on Greenwich Street. And I gave a deposit, and my mother told me to come there to pick it up. That was a piece to use a pair of 866 mercury vapor tubes and four 811As. I remember on Sideband, they gave it a halo, and you see the glow in those 866's change. On the Collins, they've been playing around with Collins. I could be wrong, but on the 5U4 was no problem. But the 5R4, for some reason you had to use the 5R4 GYA, not a 5R4 GYB, and I don't know why, but I do know if you put the solid state rectifiers in, the transformer had a very low impedance, so if you put the solid state rectifiers in, the inrush would kill the transformer. Back to you, Jake, to chew it out.
Yeah, when you read the articles that I published on the parallel kilowatt amplifier, which needed 2,000 volts at half an amp, the April issue, 1972, was the amplifier, and the May issue talked about the power supply. And as you read that article, you'll find that I burned up a couple of transformers by choosing a transformer that had the right secondary voltage and the right current capability. But because I was using a capacitor input filter network, and as you make those capacitors big enough in microfarads, and these 2,000 volts on the capacitors, so they were 3,500, something like that, rated oil-filled capacitors. You have enough capacitors in order to make the ripple very small. The good news is you get small ripple. The bad news is that only at the peak of the voltage are you doing any conduction. So you're getting a very small conduction angle as the capacitors get larger and larger. The net result of that is that the dissipation of the winding is a function of I squared R, current squared. But the current output I want is averaged 500 milliamps. So I'm keeping the output current average the same, but as you go to a smaller and smaller conduction angle, the peak current gets to a higher and higher number, therefore the I squared R gets to a bigger and bigger number. That is the dissipation of the secondary winding of the transformer. That's the R we're talking about. And a secondary winding of a 2,000 volt transformer can easily have hundreds of ohms to it. So that current, for a brief period of time, represents a lot of wattage, and the transformer burns itself up. The solution is to use choke input to power supply. All broadcast transmitters virtually use anything that runs high power, like a good broadcast transmitter for television runs something like 50,000 watts RF output. You're probably putting 100,000 or 150,000 watts into it. So at those kind of power levels, they almost exclusively run choke input power supplies. A well-designed choke input power supply, the rectifiers are conducting continuously. It's a bridge rectifier I'm talking about. So now your current is spread over the whole cycle, not just the brief cycle. And when you do that, the transformer runs cooler, your electric bill runs lower, your filtering runs cleaner, the amount of ripple goes down. It's just a little bit more of a design requirement. And you got to be careful with a choke input power supply. Now you don't have a problem with inrush current when you first turn it on. You have the opposite current problem. When you turn the power supply off, if you happen to turn it off when LIPA or Con Ed is going through 0 volts, common sense would lead you to believe that's hunky-dory. The maximum magnetic energy in your power transformer exists as the transformer goes through 0 volts. You open up the primary switch to that power supply at that instant of time, all of the magnetic energy stored in that transformer comes flying back out as an inductive kickback. That transformer that you think is capable of making 2,000 volts during that inductive kickback can make 15,000 volts if it feels like doing so. And with the choke input power supply, the choke will let it do it. And that's going to be a huge peak inverse voltage on your rectifying diode, and it could wipe them out. Therefore, you have to put a snubbering circuit, a damping circuit in there, which is what I've got in the May issue. So, there's pluses and minuses, as you can tell. Here's my real question to you, Mel, first, and maybe to Rich second. If I fell in love with 866s of mercury vapor rectifiers, and I want to go out and buy 866s today, January 2008, what would I pay? Where would I go? Is there anybody building that tube in the United States? I'm guessing the answer is no. I'm not even convinced that Svetlana...
TOS lockup detect.
I'm not even convinced that Svetlana built a tube like that. I'll bet you they are antiques, and I bet you nobody is building them. Maybe they're being built in China. But you're the guy that's running a rig with them, so you would know. KQKEY, KQRIW.
Node number 4478,
link
clear.
Power supply still has that. No, I doubt very much if there's anybody building it. When the solid state, you know, diodes came along, I think that was the final chapter of 866s. Unless, like you say, in the broadcast industry, have you seen any place where 866s are used? Maybe in a, somewhere in, maybe, well, it could be some of the older broadcast transmitters, maybe, you know. I believe, let's see, they were used in an error has occurred.
Had a TOS lockup detect.
AM broadcast transmitter that a lot of the hams are on, there's a number of hams on AM on 75 meters, are using that transmitter. They say, of course, that, you know, they changed the modes from the broadcast band and they brought them on to 80, 75 meters, and they said they only run them at about a kilowatt. That's the joke of the year. But they had 866s in them. Now, I doubt if any other, you know, transmitting equipment since then has been made.
An error has occurred.
But I could be wrong.
TOS lockup detect.
First of all, could you manufacture a tube that contains mercury thick anymore, over?
Don, good question. You'd have to go through some very special approvals, and many of the places that used to build vacuum tubes, like for instance the Amperecom facility in Hicksville, is now an extremely contaminated piece of land for the next 35 years. And nobody can build anything on it, to my knowledge. I don't know how Svetlana is getting around that problem. It might be contaminating the living daylights out of that soil, but in that particular country, they can get away with it. But for the antique radio enthusiast, and maybe you know this one, Rich, what would I pay for a pair of 866s today? Where would I go to buy them? Would I be buying them from somebody's antique shelf? Or do you think there's some place in the world that's still being built? M2EO, KQRIW.
I don't know if they're still being built in. If you look on the internet, there's a company called Antique Electronic Supply. They might have them. I'm trying to think, well, possibly, but he gets a lot of money for his stuff. Nebraska Surplus Sales might have them. They're the only two companies I can think of off the top of my head.
Interesting. Yeah, I think they're going to be as rare as hen teeth. And thank goodness we don't need them anymore. There are certain places where tubes really shine. High-power traveling wave tubes for microwave frequencies. Boy, it is hard to top the fact that one tube can give you 45 decibels of gain and 200 watts of power output at 10 to 20 gigahertz. One traveling wave tube that you can easily hold in your hand, it's about 5 pounds, can do that. 45 dB of gain, that means whatever power you put into it comes out 20 or 40,000 times stronger, 200 watts of it, and an octave wide in frequency from 10 to 20 gigs. That's what a good traveling wave tube can do. You try to do that solid state, and you will have a hell of a lot of trouble covering 5% of that bandwidth. Your final stage will give you 4 dB of gain instead of 45 dB of gain. You'll have to have protection circuits up the kazoo, because if the thing looks into an open circuit for 1 millisecond, it just wiped out $30,000 worth of transistors. The power supply would have to be 10 volts at 1,000 amperes, and I'm not kidding. You design a power supply that has extremely low ripple, and a very good crowbar circuit and protection network for 10 volts at 1,000 amperes, that is a serious design requirement. So solid state at those powers, at those frequencies, and I sat on board to try to do that because the Department of Defense needed it yesterday. They needed it so bad they could taste it, and it wasn't there to be had. Texas Instruments and a whole lot of other companies huffed and puffed and tried very hard to produce something that could come close to that requirement. Nothing comes close. You bite the bullet and you put in the traveling wave tube. There's just nothing that can equal that. So this is the solid state era we're in. But don't think that everything is solid state. For the next decade, in my opinion, there are places that where tubes will dominate by tremendous amounts.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Here's something interesting. Last invention that Limark had, they were giving out catalogs, Vintage Radio Electronics, a company called Radio Base, D-A Zulu Echo, D-A-Z-E. And I just took that catalog out. They got all kinds of things in here. They got new invention, and I'm looking, 866A, $18.50, 866AX, $18.50, 866JR, $14.06. Would you believe they got them in the catalog? They got 5R4s. They got everything in here, Dick, from from way back. I'm just flabbergasted over.
Wow, and that catalog is only a fraction of a year old. I think you said from the flea market of February or of last year or maybe the summer of last year. Alrighty. I think two things are going on. There isn't a big demand for the tubes. Therefore, the price hasn't, supply and demand hasn't made the price go straight sky high. Somebody has got a warehouse full of them, is the next guess. Somebody must have built a lot of them just before they went out of business building them. Or there's some foreign company that's still building them. For all you and I know, there's a bunch of electronics in Eastern Europe that still uses that tube. Because that tube has got a lot of efficiency, very low voltage drop. The magic of plasma, and that's what the tube is running on. That mercury vapor in there makes a plasma. Plasma really means that the gas is heated to the fourth state of matter. You know, you've got solid, liquid, gas, plasma. Plasma means that your nucleus of each molecule of the mercury, the nucleus and the electron, have been separated into a conductive gas. and that conductive gas gives you such a low voltage drop that that tube runs very efficiently. So I guess there are people using it, otherwise those prices wouldn't be that low. Fantastic. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, you want to go to their website. They'll send you a catalog, Dick. You got to read this catalog. Power transformers, everything from way, way back. Website is www.radiodaze.com. Write that down. Let them send you a catalog, Dick, and you're going to see things in there. You're going to be flabbergasted, because you're going to look at stuff I didn't realize after this. You got original glass dial scales for most of the old radios, like Philco, Bendix, Motorola, stuff from the 30s. I don't know, I guess they're duplicates. Radio Day Smith providing unique items for vintage electronics. And I mean, they got variable condensers from old radios in here. And tubes, geez, they got every tube I could possibly, I'm looking at tubes here, you know, numbers on tubes. And I'm just looking here at the 5R4s, $10. Let's see, 5U4s. 5U4s are, I guess they must be more popular, because they're $25 a piece, 5U4s. So I'm just looking at, you know, a popular tube that we used to use, 6AQ5, which audio output, number for my old receivers, $4.75. Gee, I can't imagine that they would still have these tubes, Dick. Lockpools, look at this series of 7-volt lockpools from those that were used in the car radios. Remember the car radios of the 50s and all, when they had 6-volt batteries, they used those lockpools, 7-volt filament tubes. They have the whole series of them. Oh, sockets. Oh, my God. You can go... It's like taking me back 50 years over.
Fantastic. Go ahead, Rich. Now, Rich, you should know that either you stretched your mic cord going over to your computer, or your mic has failed. Your audio was 30 decibels lower than normal. You should know that. Maybe you were stretching the mic cord to go over to the computer to look at those places, but yeah, there are significant people. I met a man who was heavily involved in broadcast 10 years ago when I visited Channel 13, a man who had a whole room of his house, a very large room dedicated to all the antique radios that he had gathered and shined them up and treated them with tender loving care. There are quite a few people out there who have affluence and for whatever reason develop a love of older radio equipment and gather it. And there are collectors of every kind. And some of these are really beautiful pieces of equipment. Radio has gone through quite a number of evolutions. I've never heard anyone say it, but the word radio today, if someone told me we're in the ninth, first, second, and third generation, alrighty. If someone told me we're in the ninth generation of radio or the 11th generation of radio, I'd believe it. We've gone through a lot of evolution. The 14th, who said that?
Good evening, WA2CDL.
Yeah, Andy, what generation is radio into right now? And Andy, how are things going with all the those high-tech interfacing you guys are involved in?
I gotta make it quick, because I gotta catch the news regarding the snowstorm, what's happening for tomorrow. I just got in. There's a couple of things that's going on regarding I'm sorry to interrupt. Just to let you know, what you're hearing is the IRLP link is timing out. It's in a COS lockup detect mode, and it times out, and that's gonna be rectified. So that's what's going on with that. That's why you're hearing what you're hearing. All right, I got stuff going on at work. So I can't stay, but I just wanted to let you know, and I'll talk to you during the week.
have audio now. Thanks, Andy. I moved away from the mic, Dick.